All right, good afternoon, everybody. This is Bio241, and it is still April, but it's April 27th. We're going to start a new chapter today, chapter 14. It has to do with hemodynamics and how the heart influences your blood pressure and how you control blood pressure, some endocrine reflexes as well as neuronal reflexes. So this is still a cardiovascular chapter. All right, so your last test is going to cover material starting today to the end of the class. I haven't looked how many lectures we got, but maybe five lectures, something like that. Five? Yeah, five lectures. All right, so I got to talk really fast. I'll just keep talking the same usual speed I usually talk at, I guess. But let's see, last time I believe you did have a test. Yeah, okay, and your results are online. I can't remember much from the test. It seems like it was a really long time ago for me. But I think everybody probably, there are a couple people that maybe did a little bit better on this test. I don't know, but I hope you all got the grade you wanted. But if you still need to make some major changes, that's a little tough. It's hard to really change a lot in your grade at this point in the class. But if you need to, and you still don't really know what to study, then you got to come talk to me or talk to some friends that are doing really well in the class, and maybe you can study with them or something. I'm not sure. Okay, but there shouldn't be too much of a mystery in terms of what to study for a test. All right, but in this time during the class. All right. So, does anybody have a question? I don't think so. Yeah. Oh, there's one. Okay. Well, you know, I'll just cover whatever chapters I can cover. And as the time approaches, I'll have a better idea of what will be on the test. So it looks like we're not going to get to the reproductive system, okay, which is too bad. All right, so let's finish up the heart. All right, so in this chapter, we're going to look at cardiac output. That's just the amount of blood that is pumped by your heart, basically per minute. We're going to look at blood and body fluid volumes because that's going to influence your cardiovascular system. It's going to influence your blood pressure. Factors affecting blood flow, you might be familiar with some of these already. For instance, like Poiseuille's equation that you worked with in lab. Okay, when you put those little glass tubes together, little glass pipes together, looked at the diameter of those pipes and what kind of blood flow if you were to hold pressure constant. And then we'll look at blood pressure, how blood pressure is controlled in your body. Okay. All right, so let's start with cardiac output. And like I said, cardiac output is just the volume of blood that's pumped by your heart every minute. And I'd mentioned one time before that the amount that the left side of your heart pumps has to equal the amount that your left side pumps because they are back to back to each other or in series. And if the right side didn't pump the same amount as the left side, then blood would back up someplace. And if it persisted for a long period of time, it would back up more and more and more and more, and eventually all the blood would end up in one spot in your cardiovascular system, right? So that doesn't happen. So within a relatively short period of time, the right side of the heart has to equal pretty much what the left side of the heart is pumping out. Every time the heart beats, remember how many phases are there in the cardiac cycle? Basically, there are how many phases? Okay, you go ahead and tell me. I like that answer. It is two, right? There's systole and diastole, right? And so the heart is pumping blood when it is in systole. So when the heart is pumping blood from the beginning of systole to the end of systole, that's how much total blood the heart pumps when it's contracting. And we call that the stroke volume, right? So when the heart pumps, it pumps out a certain amount of blood. That's the stroke volume. That's defined by the amount of blood pumped per beat every time the heart beats by each ventricle, all right? And that should be equal. The right ventricle pretty much should equal the left ventricle every time it beats. It can not be exactly equal each time, but within, say, four or five heartbeats, it's got to pretty much equal each other. All right, so how do you calculate cardiac output? Cardiac output is amount of blood pumped per minute. All right, and maybe I actually wrote this on the board one time, but cardiac output is in a volume, which, and what is milliliters? What kind of measurement is that? Is that distance? Or is that velocity or what? It's volume. All right. So that's volume per minute. That's the dimension of cardiac output. Cardiac output is equal to stroke volume. And what is stroke volume? Stroke volume is the amount of blood. So is that what, a distance or a temperature or what? That's a volume as well. So that's a milliliter per what? Per every time the heart beats. That's a milliliter per beat. And in order to figure out the flow or the cardiac output, we have to multiply that times the heart rate. And how is heart rate measured? Yeah, beats. That's the usual term per minute. And you can just undergo a really simple, nice dimensional analysis. So the beats cancel out in these dimensions. And so what are you left with? You're left with something milliliters per minute. All right, and is that what we should have for cardiac output? Yeah, absolutely. So those are the two parameters that we need to measure to know something about cardiac output. And your cardiac output is about 5 liters per minute, which is about one circulation. Right, you have about 5.5 liters of blood, and almost all of that gets pumped through your cardiovascular system every minute. All right, so let me see, make sure I didn't skip a page. Regulation of heart rate. Now, the heart has a couple different attributes to it in terms of how it can adjust cardiac output. It can adjust how much blood it pumps every time it contracts. That has to do with the force of contraction, the strength of contraction. All right, but what's another variable that can change to regulate cardiac output? Not just the force of contraction, but the heart rate as well. Okay, so these are two pretty much independent kinds of parameters on the heart. So the heart rate has to do with time, so this is what we call chronotropy of the heart. And the strength of contraction is what we call inotropy of the heart. So things that speed up the heart rate are positive chronotropic agents. Things that slow down the heart are negative chronotropic agents. What kind of nerve stimulation will have a negative chronotropic effect on the heart? The vagus nerve, for instance. Okay. What can increase the inotropy of the heart? What could be a positive inotropic agent? Okay, yeah, sympathetic stimulation like adrenaline, okay, or epinephrine, or noradrenaline, norepinephrine from the adrenal gland, or even direct sympathetic stimulation of the ventricles can increase the strength of contraction. All right, so on this particular slide, I think, I guess I'm talking about both sympathetic and parasympathetic. But the interesting thing about the heart is that without any kind of neuronal influences, the heart is autorhythmic, it will beat by itself. So if we take a heart out of any of us, any animal, even an amphibian like a frog or whatever, and put it on the table, guess what that heart is going to do, even though there's no nerves connected to it? It's going to beat, right? Okay, so what innervation does is that it regulates the heart rate. All right, so even without innervation, the SA node will drive the heart at whatever spontaneous activity the SA node is depolarizing at. That will determine the overall heart rate. All right, so normally sympathetic and parasympathetic activity influence the heart rate through the SA node. So both the parasympathetic and sympathetic nerves go to the SA node. And that's pretty nice because that just kind of what shows us what a nice antagonistic effect of those two divisions of the autonomic nervous system. So they will affect the chronotropy of the heart at the SA node. Okay. Autonomic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of heart rate. So sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve fibers modify the rate of the spontaneous depolarization of those nodal cells of the SA node. And can you picture in your mind what a nodal action potential looks like? Is there such a thing as a resting membrane potential for a nodal cell?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's always drifting around. Which way is it drifting, the resting membrane potential on a nodal cell? It's not ever flat. Okay. It actually drifts up toward threshold, and when it reaches threshold, that triggers an action potential in that cell. That was, I think, one of the test questions on your last test Wednesday. All right, well, here I have some action potentials. Now, do these look like contractile cells or do these look like nodal cells, action potentials from nodal cells? And how would you tell? I saw somebody say a nodal cell, and you're right, because if this was a myocardial cell, what would you see? You would see a nice plateau region right here, right, by those slow calcium channels that remained open, and that would prevent the heart from going into tetanus, but these are the nodal cells. All right, so here is, all right, this slope right here, these cells are just spontaneously depolarizing because of the HCN channels, and when it reaches threshold, that triggers an action potential, and then it repolarizes, and then it just slowly drifts back up to threshold, and it depolarizes again. So this will cause the heart to beat at this time, and this will cause the heart to beat at this next time. And what innervation does is that it changes the slope of this spontaneous depolarization in the heart. So norepinephrine and epinephrine stimulate the opening of these pacemaker HCN channels. Right? So if these channels are open, that causes a faster depolarization that we see in the second graph over here. And can you see that the slope of this depolarization is steeper, which means that it reaches threshold much sooner, right, compared to this time. So this is the time that it would reach under the control baseline monitoring. This is when it depolarizes under sympathetic activity, which is what? Sooner than under the control condition. And so the heart rate is increased because we see a higher frequency of action potentials being generated because the slope is a lot steeper. As opposed to parasympathetic stimulation on the SA node, so we're only talking about the SA node right here, acetylcholine promotes the opening of potassium channels. And so what does potassium do? Does it depolarize? It hyperpolarizes or repolarizes. That's the influence of potassium leaving the cell. All right, so here we see the sub-threshold membrane potential. It is still depolarizing, but at what kind of rate? A much slower rate. The slope is much more shallow, so it takes longer to reach threshold. And when that happens, that slows the heart rate down as a result. Okay, so epinephrine and norepinephrine increase the slope of, and what did we call this region right here? This was sub-threshold stimulus, but it was the potential has a certain name. That's the pacemaker potential, right? So the slope of the pacemaker potential when it's driven by epinephrine and norepinephrine is much steeper, but the pacemaker potential is much more shallow, takes longer to reach threshold when it's being controlled by acetylcholine because those potassium channels are open. All right, so is that pretty straightforward? It's pretty amazing how easy that is, actually, once you know something about these different ion channels. All right, what about, so that's how chronotropy is controlled. In the normal heart is with the SA node. If the heart is not normal, maybe the SA node is dead or damaged, or if there's a AV block or something, then there's going to be another pacemaker taking over someplace in the ventricles, for instance, or another location of the atria. All right, but don't forget, to control cardiac output, our bodies need to regulate not just the chronotropy, but also the inotropy of the heart, which is the force of contraction. Okay, all right, so there's a place in the medulla oblongata called the cardiac control center. I like to call it the cardioregulatory center. You could call it either one, cardiac control or cardioregulatory center of the medulla. Coordinates activity of autonomic innervation to the ventricles of the heart because that's what's going to regulate stroke volume. All right, and the ventricles only receive innervation from the sympathetic nervous system, not from the parasympathetic nervous system. And you might find that interesting, and I might have a couple comments about that in a little bit. So sympathetic endings in the atria and the ventricles can stimulate increased force of contraction of both the atria and the ventricles. And as the heart contracts with more force, guess what happens to stroke volume? Stroke volume goes up. It goes up. Because every time the heart beats, it doesn't pump out all of the blood that's in a ventricle. It still leaves some left over in the ventricle. As a matter of fact, under normal circumstances, 40% of the blood that is used to fill the heart during diastole gets left in the ventricle when it contracts. Only 60% gets pumped out. Okay. And so the sympathetic system can adjust that stroke volume to some large degrees. All right, so I'm not going to go over this table, but you should take a look at it. You should study it. You can see that we have different regions of the heart. Namely, we have some nodal tissues, like the SA node and the AV node, and then we have some contractile tissues, like the atrium, atrial muscle and ventricular muscle, and what controls it. And the two controlling influences will be the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. Notice that the parasympathetic nervous system only goes to the nodal tissues, not to the contractile tissues. Therefore, the parasympathetic nervous system can only regulate what part of cardiac output? Can only regulate the chronotropy, not the inotropy of it. But what about the sympathetic nervous system? It goes to nodal tissues as well as muscle tissues, so the sympathetic nervous system can regulate the chronotropy as well as the inotropy of the heart, can regulate both, okay, in determining cardiac output. Okay, so stroke volume. What is stroke volume controlled by? Basically, these three variables. And we'll cover these in this chapter. I don't know how much I'm going to talk about each right now. But the three variables are the end diastolic volume. Now tell me something about end diastolic volume. Which volume is that? Is that the big one or the little one? That's the big one. When? At the end of diastole. So what is happening during diastole?
Rest.
The heart is resting, but something very important is happening. What's happening to the heart? It's filling with blood, right? It's filling, right? So the end diastolic volume, volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. Okay, and then there's something called peripheral resistance. This is the resistance to blood flow in a blood vessel. And you learned what some parameters are that contribute to resistance. And maybe we'll just talk about some of these parameters really quick. All right, total peripheral resistance is if we were to add up the resistance of all blood vessels everywhere in the body, at least for the systemic circulation. So what are some things that you might already be aware of that would increase resistance to blood flow? When you take a blood vessel and look at its radius and you constrict it, you make the radius smaller, that means that blood has a harder time going through a narrow blood vessel because the resistance goes up. So diameter or radius of a blood vessel is very important. Okay, there's something else too. Maybe we could talk, that maybe changes the diameter of a blood vessel, makes it small, it acts like vasoconstriction. So not just the radius of a blood vessel, but what has more resistance, a really tiny, short blood vessel or a big, long one? The big, long one has a lot more resistance compared to the short one. Okay, so if you think in terms of the two kinds of circulations you have, pulmonary versus systemic, the pulmonary is very short, the systemic is very long, okay, to get the same amount of blood through it. The systemic, because it's much longer, has a much higher resistance, needs a lot more blood pressure, a lot more force to get it through there. So the left ventricle is hypertrophied compared to the right ventricle. All right, so resistance is directly related to the diameter. It's directly related to the length of the blood vessel. It's also directly related to what other property, not of the vessel itself, but of the blood, the viscosity of the blood, right? So if the viscosity of the blood increases, becomes more like molasses, does it take more or less force to get that molasses going through your blood vessels? It would take more force, more pressure, right? So that's why the hematocrit has to be regulated. You could increase the oxygen carrying capacity of the blood by putting more red blood cells into blood, but what happens to blood when you start increasing your hematocrit from 50 to 60 or 70%? Okay, but let's keep the volume the same. The volume of red blood cells goes up, but the parameter that's changing the most as you put more cells into the blood is the viscosity. So as you put more cells in the blood, the viscosity goes way up, which means what? It's not going to flow. So it doesn't do you any good to put more red blood cells so that the blood can carry more oxygen because the heart can't pump it. Right? So you might know some athletes that maybe do some red blood cell doping before an event. They'll draw some blood a couple weeks before some kind of endurance event. save the red blood cells, and right before maybe running a marathon, they'll transfuse red blood cells into their body so that they have increased oxygen carrying capacity of the blood. But does that help? Probably not that much, because what happens to cardiac output? It kind of goes down because the viscosity of the blood is so high. Okay, so that probably doesn't help very much. All right, so peripheral resistance helps determine stroke volume, and I'll show you how that happens in a little bit. Myocardial contractility, the strength of ventricular contraction, I think that's pretty straightforward to see how that affects stroke volume, because as the heart gets stronger, what happens to stroke volume? It pumps out more blood every time it pumps, right? So the stroke volume goes up as contractility increases. All right, so how can we regulate stroke volume inside our heart? A couple of different ways. The end-diastolic volume is very important, all right? And I've got a couple slides to show you why it is. It's not probably real intuitive to you at the moment, but it should be in just about a minute or so. All right, end-diastolic volume, sometimes we call that the preload on the heart. This is the workload on the heart prior to contraction. All right, so end-diastolic volume is what? The size of the heart after it fills up with blood. That's the stretching of the heart. So the amount that the heart stretches determines how much force it can generate when it does contract. And you're going to be a little bit familiar with this because we already looked at the length-tension relationship in skeletal muscle. So I'm going to review length-tension relationship just a little bit and how to picture that in your mind. All right, so stroke volume is directly proportional to preload, which is what? The end-diastolic volume, that's the stretching of the heart. So as the heart stretches, it has a tendency to get stronger because it's directly related. All right. All right, so strength of contractions varies directly with end-diastolic volume. Also, the total peripheral resistance is what we call the afterload. This is what happens after the heart is filled up with blood, right? And the afterload impedes ejection from the ventricle. So if there's a lot of resistance, the heart has a harder time pumping blood into blood vessels because there's a lot of resistance. All right, and then another thing that's very important, and we use this all the time, is to calculate the ejection fraction of a ventricle. And you calculate the ejection fraction by looking at the stroke volume, which is the amount of blood that the heart pumps every time it beats, and we divide it by how much blood was in the ventricle before it started to contract. So the ejection fraction is just the percentage of blood that's pumped out of the ventricle every time it beats. So as the contractility of the heart increases, the ejection fraction increases. As the heart gets weaker, what happens to ejection fraction? It goes down. That's the best way to think of that. So normally, ejection fraction is about 60% in a normal heart, and that's a very useful clinical diagnostic tool for the following reason. As somebody has a sick heart and it gets sicker and sicker and sicker, this ejection fraction decreases. And there gets to be a point, maybe if your ejection fraction is around 40%, 35%, okay, the prognosis is really poor. The heart's never going to recover, even though you fix some pathology inside the heart, like, for instance, a leaky valve or a septal defect or something. Or maybe even if you have hypertension and your heart gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So we can fix some of these things, but the ejection fraction is never going to come back to the way it should. So sometimes ejection fraction is used as a way to understand the timing of surgical intervention in somebody. All right? As this ejection fraction decreases more and more and more, then there's more impetus to institute some kind of correction, because if you get to a certain point, then there are irreversible changes that happen in the heart, and you'll never be able to help the patient out as a result of that. All right, so let's look at this first one right here, end-diastolic volume and its effect on stroke volume. Okay, and this is what we call the Frank-Starling law of the heart, and this is an intrinsic mechanism of the heart. All right, so intrinsic, as opposed to extrinsic. You should have a pretty good feel for what these mean. All right, intrinsic regulation means that whatever organ or system we're talking about has the ability to regulate itself. So what organ are we talking about right now?
Heart.
The heart. All right, so the heart has both of these ways that it can regulate, or it can be regulated. One way is just by the nature of the heart itself. The heart can regulate itself. That's what we call an intrinsic mechanism. All right. The heart also has extrinsic mechanisms, so the heart can be regulated by, not only by itself, but by other things that are outside the heart. Like, for instance, what? The cardioregulatory center that's in the brain. That would be an extrinsic mechanism. All right, so let's talk about intrinsic first, and that is the Frank Starling Law of the Heart. Okay, and the Frank Starling Law says that the strength of contraction, ventricular contraction, varies directly with end-diastolic volume. So if something is directly related, what does that mean? It means if one thing goes up, what does the other thing do? It goes up too. If it's inversely related, what does that mean? If one thing goes down, then the other goes up, right? But in this case, it's directly related. So if end-diastolic volume goes up, what happens to contractility, since it's directly related? It goes up as well, right? So here we have a graph that shows that. Okay, we have stroke volume, which is a measure of contractility of the heart, versus the end-diastolic volume. And what can you see on each one of these curves right here? As we start to stretch the heart more and more and more, what happens to the strength of contraction when the heart finally does beat? Notice it goes up, right? So if we stay on this curve right here, if we move to the right, where does the curve move? It moves up. It never moves down. All right, so this is the Frank Starling Law of the heart. This is an intrinsic property of the heart. As the heart fills with blood, it contracts with more vigor, with more force, which makes perfect sense. All right, that's really a nice healthy thing. As more blood is presented to the heart, it gets stronger so that it can pump that blood. This is what helps maintain the flow from the right ventricle and the left ventricle being the same. Because as the left ventricle pumps more blood, what does that mean? More blood goes to the right ventricle, it stretches more, so it's able to keep up with the left side of the heart. All right, so that's kind of what matches the output of the heart, the right and left sides. And so that's intrinsic. And as you can see, this curve switches or shifts, okay, from right to left, right, when there is sympathetic nerve stimulation. So even with sympathetic nerve stimulation, then the heart gets stronger at any particular end-diastolic volume. So let's just pick this point right here. Right? And let's just say with no sympathetic stimulation of the heart, this is kind of a baseline condition, let's just go up to this curve. What is the stroke volume? It's going to be relatively low. Right? But let's go back to that same end-diastolic volume. Now with a little sympathetic stimulation, with the same end-diastolic volume, what happens to the force of contraction? It increases, stroke volume increases, and with even more sympathetic stimulation, right, we can see that the stroke volume really increases. Right? So both of these effects are working together, sympathetic and just the stretching of the heart. All right, so here's a graph that will explain to you the length-tension relationship of the heart. So we have a graph of tension versus time of a myocardial cell. And don't forget, what's the structural and functional unit of contraction in a myocardial cell, myocardial muscle is? It's a sarcomere. It's a sarcomere just like in skeletal muscle. Not so for smooth muscle, but for cardiac and skeletal, this is true. So let's just look at one muscle. And here we can see a different number of cases. So the muscle will contract weakly for case A, and most strongly under case D, right here. So we've got A, B, C, and D. All right, and this is going to be under three different levels of stretch. And again, what's the best way to think of stretch of the heart? Stretch of a myocardial cell is going to be when the heart fills with blood. That's going to be what? The end diastolic volume, or the preload on the heart. All right, so let's look at case A, where this cell is contracting very weakly. Why is that? This cell, right, has the lowest end-diastolic volume, which is the lowest stretch of the myocardial cells. Now let's look over here at the sarcomere. So how do we envision shortening of a sarcomere? What protein actually shortens inside of a sarcomere? Is it the actin or the myosin? Neither. I'm going to trick you one of these days, but not today, I see. Okay, so how do you explain shortening of a sarcomere? It's what? Yeah, it's the actin and myosin sliding over each other, right? It's the sliding filament model for contraction. But under this case right here, case A, right, can this sarcomere shorten anymore? Notice that the Z discs are almost butted up against the myosin already, so the Z lines really can't come any closer together. So this sarcomere, even though it's not contracting, this is right at the end of diastole. It's not stretched out. So when this muscle is told to contract, it really can't because the filaments can't slide over each other and generate tension. All right, so how can we improve that? Well, let's stretch the muscle out a little bit. Let's pull the Z lines apart. All right, so now we don't see quite so much overlap between the actin and myosin, and now this cell can actually shorten because they can slide over each other, and that will generate a little bit of tension, curve B over here. And if we stretch it out some more, we get curve C, which is what? Increased tension. And if we look at case D right here, all right, dang, that looks really close to C. Somebody should redraw this figure, okay? Don't just pretend I didn't say that, all right? Now we see what? Kind of an optimal, we see maximum stretching of the sarcomere, but there's still overlap of the actin and myosin filaments, so they can slide over each other and produce a tremendous amount of tension as a result. All right, so overlap of actin and myosin is determined by what? The stretch of the myocardium, which is due to what? What volume of the heart? The end-diastolic volume. So that's why when you increase end-diastolic volume, contractility goes up, stroke volume goes up, because you get more optimal overlap of the actin and myosin filaments so that they can slide past each other. Oh, I guess that's not bad. This is still a smaller distance than it is here. Okay, that's good. I was looking at it on an angle. All right, so that's what we call the Frank-Starling law of the heart. That's just an intrinsic mechanism because what? It's just due to the actin and myosin arrangement within the sarcomere. Okay. So that has that plays some really important roles on how we like to treat patients. All right, let's take a look at this graph, and I'll show you, I'll draw something on the board in just a second. All right, now for, you know what? I'll do it right now. So let's look at this right here. So why is this important for how we like to treat patients with cardiovascular disease or some kind of trauma to their cardiovascular system? So let's draw this Frank Starling curve. We had, what are these axes? Probably you should be able to draw these axes. The vertical axis is stroke volume, and you could maybe put contractility. All right, as stroke volume increases, the force of contraction increases, right, the contractility, versus what? End diastolic volume, or stretch of the heart. And they're directly related to each other. All right, this is what we call the ascending limb of the Frank-Starling curve. Under normal circumstances, we're all operating maybe right about here in our normal everyday life, not exactly right at optimum. So that means that if for whatever reason there's a little bit more venous return, more blood getting back to the heart, our heart still can compensate and it can beat stronger. Okay. Now over here, this is the descending limb. Would anybody like to be on the descending limb of the Frank-Starling curve? Because what's happening? What's happening? Look at stroke volume as we proceed out with end-diastolic volume. What's happening to the heart? It's getting weaker and weaker and weaker because now what's happening? The myosin and actin are stretched so far apart from each other that there's hardly any overlap, so there are hardly any cross bridges that can form. That's not going to generate very much force. And if you stretch the sarcomere out completely to where there's no overlap, what happens to tension that can be developed? If there's no overlap, it's going to actually go to zero, right? And what happens to you if your cardiac output goes to zero? Because remember, if stroke volume goes to zero, what about cardiac output? Right, cardiac output is just directly related to stroke volume times heart rate. So if stroke volume goes to zero, what happens to cardiac output? Well, it goes to zero too, right? Then you got like 3 seconds of consciousness and 3 minutes of brain life, and then you're dead forever. All right, so that's real important to know. All right, so when might you be operating on this ascending limb. Okay, what happens if, unfortunately, maybe on the way home tonight, maybe you rode a motorcycle in, you get into a motorcycle accident, and you lacerate a femoral artery or a subclavian artery on the way home. Instead of blood in your circulatory system, it's like gushing out of your body onto the pavement. What happens to your end diastolic volume then? Instead of blood returning to the heart, stretching it out, right, it's outside of your body. Now, here's the really terrible thing, right? Of course, it's never a good thing for you to run out of blood, but as you lose end diastolic volume, what happens to the strength of your heart? It goes down. So at the time when your heart needs to get stronger, what's it doing? It's getting weaker just because of that Frank Starling law, intrinsic property of the heart. All right, so that's real important that you stop that kind of bleeding, so to protect your heart function. All right, so under conditions of hemorrhage over here, what would we, even paramedics, what could a paramedic do for you, even on the way to the hospital?
Stop the bleeding.
Okay, but they can do something to bring your heart back so you don't go into shock. And what can they do? They can hook up an IV. Okay, they can't transfuse you. They can't give you blood, but they can at least give you fluid, right? They can give you saline. That saline goes into your cardiovascular system. That saline that's in your cardiovascular system does what to end diastolic volume? It starts to stretch the heart out, and what happens to contractility of the heart then? It starts to climb back up the Frank Starling curve, right? And now you got your cardiac output back, and that can maintain blood pressure, right? Just by giving you fluids. So that's pretty cool. All right, so that's important. Now other people, maybe as a result of hypertension, all right, their heart is failing, and their kidneys aren't working very much, their fluid volume goes way up. All right, they have way too much fluid in their blood. And if there's too much fluid in their blood, what happens to end diastolic volume? It increases. The heart now starts to get overstretched. And when it gets overstretched, what happens to contractility? It starts to go down. So the heart gets weaker and weaker. Fluid builds up more. The heart gets weaker. Fluid builds up more and more. The heart gets weaker, right? So this is typically when somebody's in heart failure, what it looks like. They have a fluid overload. So how could we treat somebody with a fluid overload that's in heart failure? How could we get rid of some of these fluids in their cardiovascular system? Give them a diuretic. Have them pee that fluid right out of their body. And guess what happens to contractility? It starts to go up. Their heart gains function, right? And you could probably save somebody's life just by giving a diuretic. All right, so that might be the first line of treatment for somebody, right, that's in heart failure. Diuretic, just because you're working with that intrinsic property of the heart. So it's real important to have a pretty good understanding of that, okay, under those two circumstances. And that's all due to what? Understanding the overlap of actin and myosin within a sarcomere, right? That's just relying on some basic information. All right, so that's all intrinsic control. Here's extrinsic control of contractility. All right, so at any given end diastolic volume, contraction depends on the level of sympathetic tone. And sympathetic tone is just the result of nerve impulses coming down the sympathetic nervous system plus whatever sympathetic drive is being provided by the adrenal gland, because the adrenal gland releases what? Epinephrine and norepinephrine, right? So here we have a graph, again, of relative tension versus length of muscle as a percent of its optimal length. And these first two curves right here are cardiac muscle. We can see that this is the tracing without epinephrine. Okay, and then here is the cardiac muscle with epinephrine. And we can see that at any end diastolic volume, let's just pick maybe this 80% right here, right? Notice without epinephrine, it contracts very weakly, but with epinephrine, it has what? Enhanced contractility. And where does this epinephrine come from? Is this something that the heart is producing? Is it intrinsic? It's coming from outside the heart, so this is what we call an extrinsic mechanism, right? So that includes, of course, the cardioregulatory center in the medulla, all the nerves, and it might even then also entail the adrenal medulla, as well as the medulla oblongata. Okay, so sympathetic or adrenal sympathetic activity or sympathetic tone, however you want to talk about it, exhibits what? A positive inotropic effect on the heart. All right, but don't forget, we're forgetting about, it's also going to have a positive chronotropic effect on the heart because it's going to adjust that slope of the pacemaker potential in those nodal fibers as well. All right, but the inotropic effect is going to be due to an increase of calcium in the sarcomeres, and that's just going to maintain cross-bridge cycling. Okay, so that's the effect of norepinephrine and epinephrine within the sarcomeres of cardiac muscle. All right, so cardiac output is controlled by heart rate. Oh, it's drawn a little bit differently than I have it on the board. I always say stroke volume times heart rate, but here's your book that says what? Heart rate times stroke volume. So what is heart rate determined by? Both sympathetic, which is going to be a positive, and parasympathetic, because they both go to the nodal fibers in the heart, both the SA node and AV node. Okay. But only the sympathetic nerves go to the myocardial tissue itself that's going to have some kind of inotropic effect, right? So we just saw in the previous slide that the strength of contraction will increase, so stroke volume will increase as a result, okay? And also, it's going to be due to the Frank Starling law, right? How much the heart fills with blood that determines the stretch or the end diastolic volume that's going to determine stroke volume. And cardiac output is going to then control blood pressure in the heart. But I think from this slide, you should be aware that cardiac output is what? Directly related to heart rate and stroke volume. So if either one goes up, cardiac output goes up. If either one goes down, cardiac output goes down. If they both go up, what happens to cardiac output? It goes up in a big way, faster way, right? Okay, so they are directly related to each other. All right, so what can control end diastolic volume? So veins are kind of interesting because they're not just straight tubes. They can dilate. And when they dilate, a lot of blood can pool in a vein, or they can constrict. And when they constrict, that forces a bunch of blood back into the circulatory system to be used. All right, so that determines, that constriction of veins determines of return of blood to the heart, which is what we call venous return. All right, so venous return controls end diastolic volume. And when you adjust end diastolic volume, what happens? What happens when you have increased end diastolic volume? Increased end diastolic volume, you have increased contractility of the heart. That increases stroke volume. Stroke volume increases, that increases cardiac output. Okay, so you just got to memorize that equation. Cardiac output is equal to stroke volume times heart rate to generate a feel for what's going on here. But if you can just think in terms of what's directly related or inversely related, that's fine. Okay. All right, so end diastolic volume is dependent on blood volume and venous pressure. Right? If we take a bunch of blood out, venous return is going to be reduced. The heart's going to get weaker. If blood volume goes up, more blood is going to return to the heart. The heart's going to get stronger. It's also determined by venous pressure, right? So that when veins constrict, the pressure in a vein goes up. That's going to increase venous return. And what other things can affect return of blood to the heart? I think we talked about this in the last chapter. There are two things that help venous return. There's the valves, so that when you contract the skeletal muscle around a vein, that pressurizes the vein, and blood is only going to squirt what direction? Back to the heart, because veins have valves in them. Okay, and also the respiratory pump. When the pressure in our thorax is decreased, when we expand our rib cage, not only does that suck air into our lungs, but that sucks blood from our periphery into our thoracic cavity. Right? And then when we exhale, that increases the pressure, but blood can't go back. Why can't blood go back out to the periphery when we pressurize our chest? Because there are valves in veins, right? Same reason. Okay. So the two pumps that bring blood back to the heart for venous return, okay, are the skeletal muscle pumps and something we call the respiratory pump, when intrathoracic pressure drops during inhalation. That helps return blood to the heart. Okay. So this end diastolic volume, okay, is controlled by venous return. And what are the three things that can control venous return? Well, blood volume, right? How can we control blood volume? Well, we said by controlling urination or micturition, right? So if we lose a lot of fluid by taking a diuretic, for instance, that's going to decrease our blood volume, that's going to decrease venous return, decrease end diastolic volume, that's going to decrease cardiac output. And guess what effect that's going to have on blood pressure if your cardiac output goes down? It's directly related as well. It's going to go actually down. Yeah, so if you increase urine volume, you decrease blood volume, you decrease venous return, you decrease end diastolic volume, you decrease cardiac output, that means your blood pressure is going to go down. Okay, and breathing. Okay, breathing increases venous return, increases end diastolic volume, increases cardiac output. The same thing for the skeletal muscle pump. That increases venous return, and then sympathetic tone, okay, causes venoconstriction, which moves more blood that's pooled into your cardiovascular system, and that's going to increase contractility as well by increasing venous return and end diastolic volume. All right, so here is a graph that shows where we find most of the blood in our body, and it's broken down into small veins and venules, large veins, capillaries, systemic arteries, the heart, and the lungs. So it's both pulmonary and systemic circulation right here. Where do we have most of the blood in our body? Yeah, these small veins and venules right here, about 70%. So these are what we call capacitance blood vessels because they hold most of the capacity of the blood. They're thin, so they can stretch pretty easily, but they do have smooth muscle so that if your body needs more blood to circulate through arteries, guess where your body can get that blood from? From these veins right here by venoconstriction, right? Just by simple venoconstriction. And when more blood enters the circulatory system, that will what? Maintain blood pressure. Your blood pressure will go up. Okay, so these are high compliance vessels because they're very thin. All right, so you saw how stroke volume influences cardiac output, right? And that's influenced by what? The end diastolic volume, which is how much the heart stretches out, and that's influenced by how much blood you have in your body. And so how much blood volume you have in your body can be influenced by your kidneys, because your kidneys are going to either excrete or withhold excretion of fluids, and it's going to end up in your circulatory system. All right, so the most important way in the long-term regulation of blood pressure and function of your heart is accomplished by your kidneys, because it's regulating fluid volume inside your body. And that's done through hormonal mechanisms. So here are three hormones that adjust fluid levels in your body, and thus blood volume, and thus blood pressure. So if you're not maintaining your fluids, your blood pressure is going to be all over the place, right? If you lose too much fluid, maybe you're perspiring too much, your blood pressure is going to drop, and you might go into cardiovascular failure or shock as a result of that. Okay. So here are the three hormones. Antidiuretic hormone. What's another name for antidiuretic hormone? And I'll probably just call it by that. ADH. Yeah, ADH. All right. What does ADH do? Can you kind of picture? Is it going to increase blood pressure or decrease blood pressure? And how?
Increase blood pressure.
Okay. So antidiuretic hormone means it works the opposite of a diuretic. So you're going to retain fluid as a result of antidiuretic hormone. If you retain fluid, what happens to your blood pressure? It's going to go up, right? Okay. We'll look at that a little bit more. Aldosterone is a hormone that is going to make you retain fluid. It's going to make you retain salt. And when you keep salt in your body, guess what happens to fluid? In osmosis, it draws fluid into your body. So your blood volume is going to be maintained or go up. So what do you think the effect of aldosterone is? Decrease in BP or increase in blood pressure? It's going to be an increase in blood pressure, right? So antidiuretic hormone and aldosterone are acting synergistically with each other. They're working the same, right? Atrial natriuretic hormone. This is the third one. That is secreted by, guess what it's secreted by? The atrium, that's right. Atrial, that's coming from the atrium of the heart. And as fluids accumulate in your body, what happens to stretching of the heart? Does it go up or down as you retain fluids?
Up.
It goes up, so the atrium start to stretch. As a result, the atria release atrial natriuretic hormone, which goes to the kidney, makes you pee, and then what does your blood volume do then? It goes down, so here's another nice homeostatic mechanism. So atrial natriuretic hormone act antagonistically to aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone. So here are some nice systems that maintain nice antagonistic control. All right, so when I'm done talking about this subchapter, make sure you can answer this question. Which of the above hormones are synergistic and which are antagonistic to each other? All right, so I kind of alluded to it already, but let's take a look. All right, so ADH has another name, vasopressin. All right, vasopressin, any kind of pressor agent is some kind of agent that will maintain your blood pressure or increase your blood pressure. That's a pressor agent. All right, and ADH is what we used to call vasopressin. So ADH is released by the posterior pituitary. Ah, you were tested on this already. Okay, posterior pituitary. When the osmoreceptors in the hypothalamus, all right, detect high osmolality. And what's that? That means high salt, right? So when your blood gets salty, all right, so when your blood gets salty, what should your body do? Retain fluids to dilute that salt out, right? So that should kind of make sense to maintain osmolality, all right? So how do you dilute that salt out? Well, the hypothalamus gives you the sensation that you're thirsty and you want to drink water and hopefully nice fresh water. And it also stimulates water resorption from urine. So it's going to work on the kidneys to pull water out of urine, so and that water goes into your cardiovascular system and dilutes the salt out, and your urine becomes very small amounts but very salty as a result of that. So urine production can be adjusted depending on how much fluid your body needs to retain. If you have too much fluid in your body, guess what urine is going to be like? Very dilute, very, very dilute and copious amounts, right? If you're low on fluids inside your body, urine is going to be very salty, but what? Very minuscule amounts, right? So that's how the kidney is going to adjust, and it does that partially through antidiuretic hormone, which is coming again from where? I forgot. Posterior pituitary. Yeah, that posterior pituitary. Okay, so antidiuretic hormone release is inhibited by low osmolality, which means what? Which means, watery kind of blood, not that's below normal. So this might be an exam figure right here. Okay, so here is a response loop. The stimulus, let's just say, is dehydration. So when you're dehydrated, what happens to your blood volume? It goes down, and what happens to the saltiness of your blood when you're dehydrated? It goes up. So now your blood is salty. What's another way, all right, besides dehydration, of increasing the saltiness of your blood? Like drinking a bunch of margaritas with salt on it, right? Just eating a lot of salt is going to increase your osmolality of your blood, right? So dehydration or salt ingestion increases blood osmolality, right? That's pretty straightforward. And what monitors blood osmolality? The hypothalamus. The hypothalamus. Okay, we're going to talk about the kidneys in just a little bit. The hypothalamus has osmolality receptors, osmoreceptors. Okay, and that's the integration center. So as your blood becomes more salty, what's the decision the hypothalamus is going to do? It's going to say you're thirsty, all right, number one, to dilute that salt. But it's also going to signal the posterior pituitary via the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, There are axons that go right down through the infundibulum to the posterior pituitary, and they will release antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone then goes to the kidneys and signals what? Retention of water, resorption of water from the fluid that's in your kidneys that will become urine eventually. And that water ends up in the blood. So what does that do to blood volume? That increases blood volume. The water that you drink when you're thirsty ends up by increasing blood volume, decreasing blood osmolality. Well, as your blood volume increases, what happens to your heart? Its end-diastolic volume increases. Your heart then goes back to a normal, strong contractility. All right, so ADH is real important for maintaining heart function as well as osmolality. Yeah. Oh, it sure can. Absolutely. So let's go the opposite way, right? So if you ingest a lot of salt, okay, your blood osmolality is going to go way up, and then that's going to trigger the release of antidiuretic hormone. And because you've eaten salt, you're going to retain fluids because ADH is going to make kidneys resorb fluid from the kidneys, and that's going to increase your blood pressure. So if somebody has hypertension, what's hypertension? Abnormally high blood pressure, right? And if salt ingestion because of ADH increases blood pressure, so should somebody with hypertension ever eat potato chips that are salty, or margaritas that are salty, or french fries that are salty? Absolutely not. That's like the worst thing that they can do, right? So people with hypertension shouldn't eat salt at all, right? They should, and that's really hard to do. You can't buy any kind of prepared food that doesn't have probably 10 times the minimum daily requirement of salt in the United States. Right? You probably have to make all your own food if you're trying to treat hypertension that way. Okay? All right, so that's that. That's a real important insight that you have right there. Yeah, diuretic can help. All right, we'll talk about some of that stuff. Okay. All right, so that's ADH. What about aldosterone? You know a lot about aldosterone already. All right, it's a steroid hormone, which means what? It's lipophilic, right? It's a steroid hormone. That means it's got to have cytoplasmic or nuclear receptors in order for it to work. But where is aldosterone secreted by? It's adrenal. You're close. Adrenal. Remember, there's a cortex and a medulla. What's secreted by the medulla? That's epi and norepi. So this is from the adrenal cortex. Adrenal cortex. All right, this helps maintain blood volume, and blood volume, if you maintain blood volume, that helps maintain what? Proper blood pressure because of that end-diastolic volume deal through the Frank-Starling law. Okay, helps maintain blood volume and blood pressure through reabsorption and retention of salt and water from the urine. So it kind of acts like ADH. All right, so aldosterone is released from the adrenal cortex from salt deprivation. All right, so this is a little bit different than ADH. Low blood volume and low blood pressure all cause the release of aldosterone. All right, and that's going to then cause the retention of salt from the kidney, the retention of water from the kidney, and that's going to increase blood pressure. So aldosterone is one of the more important hormones that maintain your blood pressure on a long-term basis. All right, so here is the more complete mechanism involving aldosterone. And this is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. This is the most important system for maintaining blood pressure in the long term. And people that have hypertension, right, we can help people with hypertension by adjusting the system or confounding the system, but we believe that this is the system that's misbehaving in somebody that has hypertension. Right? So is hypertension very prevalent in the United States? Absolutely. So guess what? You should know this system backwards and forwards. Right? And sometimes I call this the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, but you know what? You guys can get over it. It shouldn't be that dreaded for you. All right, so let's take a look at it. Okay. When there is a salt deficit, low blood volume, or low blood pressure, angiotensin 2 is produced. All right, so this is an important hormone. Angiotensin 2 causes a number of effects, all aimed at increasing blood pressure, in that it can cause an increase in vasoconstriction. Vasoconstriction increases blood pressure. Probably next time I'll show you how that happens. It's not intuitive to you right now. All right, angiotensin 2 causes the release of aldosterone. All right, so aldosterone then causes you to retain fluids, which then increases blood volume, increases blood pressure. Angiotensin 2 also stimulates your sense of thirst. All right, so not only do you stop losing fluids in the urine, you add fluids to your body by drinking. All right, so here is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism that you should be able to draw out. This is an exam figure that you'll have to label on the test, but you should be able to label this thing, just draw it de novo, and you'll breeze through it on the test in like a minute or so. All right. So let's look at the stimulus. The stimulus to this mechanism is a decrease in blood pressure, and when there's decreased blood pressure, there's going to be decreased blood flow to the kidneys. So where this starts is at the kidneys. There are special things in the kidneys, and maybe in anatomy you learned about the juxtaglomerular apparatus. Maybe everybody didn't get that to that in anatomy, but this is right at the entrance to a nephron within the kidney. And remember, the nephron, the kidneys have, I was going to say 300 million nephrons, but I'm going to have to look that up. Okay, I've lost track of that figure. But how many nephrons does a kidney have? Millions. Just say millions for right now. Right. So you got millions of these juxtaglomerular apparatuses that are monitoring what? Blood pressure and flow to the kidneys. If blood pressure decreases, blood flow is going to decrease to the kidney. And if that pressure or flow decreases, the juxtaglomerular apparatus releases an enzyme called renin. R-E-N-I-N. There's another enzyme called R-E-N-N-I-N. It's used for digestion, but this is one that's released into the blood. Okay. Now let's look and see what renin does. There's a compound called angiotensinogen. What can you tell me about angiotensinogen? You've probably never heard of it before. It's not active because of nomenclature. Anything with an ogen is inactive, but it can be activated right away. What's it activated by? By renin from the kidneys under the conditions of decreased blood pressure or decreased flow. And that makes angiotensin 1. Angiotensin 1 has some activity to increase blood pressure, but not very much. All right? Angiotensin 1 really has to be converted into angiotensin 2, and it's converted into angiotensin 2 in the lungs. Right, there's an enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme. Guess what people like to call angiotensin converting enzyme? ACE. That's right. ACE. Converts angiotensin 1, which is not very effective, into angiotensin 2. Angiotensin 2 is very effective. Right? It affects the adrenal cortex to release aldosterone. Aldosterone then goes from the adrenal cortex, that's a hormone, gets into the blood, goes to the kidney. That increases salt and water retention. And what does that do to blood volume? As you retain blood volume, that increases blood volume, that increases blood pressure. Angiotensin 2 also causes vasoconstriction of arterioles, and that's going to increase blood pressure. All right, so both of these increase blood pressure. All right, so what is this response compared to the stimulus? Does it add to it or subtract from the stimulus? Okay, we have what? Increasing blood pressure, right? And what the stimulus was a decrease in blood pressure. So what kind of feedback mechanism is this? It's a nice negative feedback mechanism. If everything is working correctly, should maintain blood pressure at the proper level, right? But for some reason, people with hypertension, this is not, the set point is misset, or there's something wrong with this mechanism to where it's not working. Their blood pressure is way too high. All right, so this is the dreaded renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So what do you have to know? What secretes renin? The kidney. All right, when blood pressure decreases, renin is just an enzyme. It converts angiotensinogen into angiotensin. but that's not active. That has to be activated by the lungs via this enzyme called angiotensin converting enzyme, otherwise we call it ACE, right? Then angiotensin 2 causes the release of aldosterone, and that aldosterone causes salt, in particular sodium, not so much potassium, but sodium retention and water retention, which boosts blood volume and blood pressure back up. Angiotensin also causes vasoconstriction, and I want to say venoconstriction, but I'm not sure about that. I would suspect that it does, but I probably shouldn't tell you unless I know for sure. Maybe you could do a Google on that by Wednesday and let me know if angiotensin 2 is a venoconstrictor as well. Okay, it might cost me a couple points, all right, but maybe do a Wikipedia or something. But in any case, it's going to increase blood pressure, which is what the opposite compared to what the, that opposes what the initial stimulus is, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. All right, so this renin angiotensin aldosterone mechanism is misbehaving with somebody with hypertension. How can we lower somebody's blood pressure? Okay, one easy way would be, let's get rid of some of this blood volume. How can we get rid of some of that blood volume?
A diuretic.
Give somebody a diuretic, right? Lower that blood volume. Blood pressure is going to come back down. But what if somebody's set point has it set for hypertension? Even though you lose blood volume, what's going to happen?
Oh, it's weaker, the heart.
Well, other things are going to compensate in your body. Maybe there'll be venoconstriction, okay? And your blood pressure is going to go back up, even though it initially went back down. So unfortunately, with hypertension, patients usually can't take just one drug because their body compensates and boosts their blood pressure back up. So somebody with hypertension might have to take one, okay, which is in effect two, maybe three different kinds of medications, okay, that work with this renin angiotensin system. So I put some things here. All right, but first off, don't forget, this is the most important system for mechanism for long-term regulation of blood pressure. So you got to know it in and out. So how can you manage hypertension? By diuretics, right? Getting rid of blood volume. What else? You somehow want to interrupt this mechanism. You can interrupt it by maybe inhibiting this enzyme right here, the interconversion of angiotensin 1 into angiotensin 2 in the lung. And so there are things called ACE inhibitors. What? Angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors. And what does that do? That interrupts this mechanism and somebody's blood pressure is going to decrease as a result of that ACE inhibitor. Furthermore, okay, in order for angiotensin 2 to have an effect on the adrenal cortex, how does the adrenal cortex know to listen for angiotensin 2? What does it have to have? It's got to have a receptor. Right, and if that receptor is blocked, then that's going to block the effect. That's going to block the release of aldosterone, and that's going to block that increase in blood volume. It's going to block that increase in blood pressure. So there are also ARBs that can be prescribed, and those are angiotensin receptor blockers. Angiotensin receptor blockers can be used to decrease somebody's blood pressure. So that works at what the level of the adrenal cortex. All right, so that's why it's so important to know this mechanism, because each step in this mechanism you might want to manipulate to help somebody with hypertension. All right, what are some other ways? Well, beta blockers, that doesn't really influence this mechanism, but what does a beta blocker do? Like a beta 1, what's the effect of beta 1 stimulation going to be? That's parasympathetic, but beta is a adrenergic agonist, right? If you block the beta ones, that's sympathetic. That's going to block sympathetic tone to the heart. So what's going to happen to the heart? It's going to get slower, but it's going to contract less strongly. So the stroke volume is going to go down. Blood pressure is going to go down with a beta blocker as well. Okay. Calcium channel blockers. What does a calcium channel do for the heart? Calcium is excitatory, so if you block calcium, what happens to the heart? It's inhibited, it gets weaker. What happens to blood pressure when the heart gets weaker? Blood pressure goes down. But for these beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, it not only works on the myocardial cells, but it works on the smooth muscle cells of arterioles and the smooth muscle of veins, all right? And what happens when smooth muscles of arterioles and veins relax? They dilate, yeah, they venodilate, so then blood pools in the veins, right? And vasoconstriction of arterioles decreases, that decreases blood pressure as well. So beta blockers and calcium channel blockers work at the level of the heart, but also for constriction of veins and arterioles. And there's all kinds of these different pharmaceutical agents. If you're interested in these, you can do a Google search and find out all the latest and greatest beta blockers and calcium channel blockers, but that's basically how they work. Okay, and alpha 2 agonists, we didn't talk about this very much when we talked about alpha 1s and alpha 2s and beta 1s and beta 2s in here. Okay, but an alpha 2 agonist is going to cause vasodilation. And I don't want to go into exactly how that works. Okay, but a good alpha 2 agonist would be something like clonidine. So if somebody walks into your office with really high blood pressure and you need to control it within a couple minutes, or somebody might have their brain blow up or something because of a stroke because their blood pressure is so high, unfortunately that happens. Clonidine, boom, their blood pressure is just going to drop. But you would never think of like taking a test or something like that on clonidine. Some people can tolerate it pretty well, but if any of us took clonidine, we probably couldn't function. Okay, because our blood pressure would be so low, right? That's due to the alpha 2 receptors that are in our brain. Oh, here's a little, you could probably, if you download these files, what I have a little link to WebMD where you could check out these various pharmaceutical agents. But nonetheless, because the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system is so important in regulating blood pressure, right, you should just know all the steps. I'm not going to ask you during the test maybe to figure any of these different pharmaceutical agents out. Maybe at the maybe there's some questions on the web that talk about ACE inhibitors, okay, and what the effect of an ACE inhibitor is on blood pressure. You might have to know something about that one, okay? And then diuretic, you should probably just have an intuitive feel for how that would affect blood pressure. That's a pretty easy one to get an intuitive feel for. All right, so y'all see how important this mechanism is for regulating blood pressure? So, yeah, you just might want to make a little copy of this slide and put it in your pocket for the next 10 years or so, okay? That's pretty handy. All right, so what did we cover so far? ADH increases blood volume, increases blood pressure. Aldosterone, as related through the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone mechanism, increases blood pressure, so aldosterone and ADH are synergistic to each other. All right. The action is a little bit different, but not too much. Atrial natriuretic hormone, on the other hand, is a diuretic. And the result is because as blood volume increases, the atrium stretches, there are stretch receptors in the atrium of the heart, and as they stretch, that causes release of atrial natriuretic hormone, right? Atrial natriuretic hormone has a couple of effects. It inhibits aldosterone. So if it inhibits aldosterone, what's the effect? Synergistic or antagonistic?
Antagonistic.
Antagonistic right there, right? So it's antagonistic. It promotes salt and water excretion. So again, it's antagonistic to ADH and aldosterone. And as a result, that lowers blood volume, right? It also promotes vasodilation. Both of these effects right here do what? They lower blood pressure. Okay? When there's too much venous return, overstretching of the heart in the normal heart, atrial natriuretic hormone, your book calls it a peptide, it's the same thing, lowers blood pressure. So it is antagonistic to both aldosterone and to ADH. This might be an exam figure. I don't know if it is or not. Might not be. But this just shows the mechanism of how atrial natriuretic hormone works. So if there's increased blood volume, you have increased venous return, the heart stretches, right? And when the heart stretches, so does the atrium. The atrium is going to release atrial natriuretic hormone that causes increase that goes to the kidney. So there are receptors for atrial natriuretic hormone in the kidney that increases sodium chloride and water excretion, which increases urine volume, that decreases blood volume, right? So that's feeds back negatively to that increased venous return, and that should bring blood pressure back to that normal level. A stretch of the atrium also stimulates the vagus nerve. It sends signals to the brain, namely the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus then to the posterior pituitary to decrease the secretion of antidiuretic hormone. All right, so you can see the antagonistic effect of stretching of the atrium with ADH secretion. Right, that decreases water resorption or retention, increasing urine volume, decreasing blood volume, and that forms a nice negative feedback loop, maintaining blood pressure. Okay. All right, so I think we're done today. Remind me to start with factors affecting blood flow. And you might want to look over the, here's Poiseuille's equation. This is the guy that you dealt with in lab already. All right, so anybody got any questions before we wrap up? Well, what about the sign-in sheet? Did I pass the sign-in sheet around? It's around someplace? Yeah, make sure you sign the sign-in sheet before you go.